Hello and welcome. This is Non-Applicable. My name is Nick.
I'm Adam.
And we have our guest.
I'm Alexandra Hunt.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. Thank you for being here with us, Alexandra. You know, this is a pretty awesome occasion for Non-Applicable, our second ever interview with someone who is running for elected office. Thank you again for being here. And, you know, we just want you to be able to tell folks and tell us, just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background and such. So feel free.
Sure. As I said, my name is Alexandra Hunt, and I'm running for the House of Representatives in PA3, which is a big chunk of Philadelphia. It's got the Northwest, West, Center City, and a good portion of South Philly as well. I grew up with two parents who are teachers. My father is a history teacher, my mother a French teacher. I graduated in college in 3 years to save money, even while working two jobs as a server and a stripper to make ends meet. I'm a survivor of two sexual assaults, and I moved to Philadelphia to complete two different master's degrees and ended up staying. I've spent time working for the Lakota on Pine Ridge Reservation, and I currently work in public health. I'm a prison abolitionist and a community organizer for mass liberation. And up until recently, I was a soccer coach, but after my transparency on the campaign trail of formerly working as a sex worker, I was pushed out of my job, unfortunately.
Unfortunate to hear in that sense. Adam, go ahead.
Well, we have some getting to know you questions, but before we get to like the fun ones, I just want to ask, you know, what was the impetus for this primary challenge against Dwight Evans? What made you want to run?
I think it was an overwhelming sense of urgency and frustration. I mean, before the pandemic, while I've always been politically active and an active community member, and after seeing Bernie Sanders 2016 run for president, I realized that there was a place in politics for someone with my views. However, I never considered running for office. And then with the absurd amount of neglect from our government and lack of response during this pandemic, I was volunteering at a food distribution site, and I was just looking at how long the line was. It wrapped down the street. And these were people in Philadelphia who didn't have food, who were food insecure. And that's completely a policy choice. And I just had, you know, the thought run through my head of what are you waiting for? And that's when I decided that I was going to run. It was a very scary decision to make, but I am glad that I have.
Great. And just to get a little more in specifically into specifically Dwight Evans, just, you know, as an outsider looking in, I mean, I live in Northeast PA. I don't know anything about, I know very little about Dwight Evans. What about Dwight Evans makes you want to primary him? I know you said that, you know, Bernie Sanders, you're more in that camp. So what about him makes him not in that realm?
Oh, I mean, nothing of his policy is within that realm. He's in the progressive caucus, but there's a new clause of that caucus that if you don't support progressive policy, you can actually be removed. And so I'm wondering if he's going to be removed because he doesn't actually support progressive policy. My main criticism of Dwight Evans is his complacent leadership or even lack of leadership. Philadelphia is being left behind. We are the number one impoverished large city in America, and we're hurting and we need radical change. And Dwight Evans has demonstrated in his 41-year career in politics his unwillingness to step out of the mainstream and really fight for the systemic change that we need and that we demand of him. So that I was kind of looking at the political machine that sits in Philadelphia, and it's known for its corruption. It's known for you know, taking pieces of the pie that's supposed to come to the community until all we're left with is crumbs. And it runs on corporate greed, and it runs on intimidation. And my opponent is a piece of that. And so that's what helped make this decision as well.
It's interesting because when I mean I tried to look up Dwight Evans, and a lot of the bad stuff he's done, you really can't find much about it, because you know, you just look at his Wikipedia and he's like, oh, he's in the Medicare for All caucus and the Progressive caucus, so you just assume
he is no longer I think that for everyone in the district, that was so infuriating that he was in Medicare for All caucus and would not support Medicare for All. He's very much backed by private health insurance companies. And so he's actually no longer in that caucus as of the recent Congress, which is good, because that was, as people have heard about my run for Congress in this district, I've been getting phone calls from people that were like, thank goodness, I am so angry with our representative for not supporting Medicare for All. And that sole piece of policy is a major issue in this district. We really want Medicare for All. We want him to sign on, and he won't.
And I'll also mention, I know that Adam and I know this very well, as I'm sure you do, of, you know, a lot of the times politicians that might even be in the Progressive caucus and such aren't necessarily progressive. And also that term progressive has been sort of manipulated, changed, or really just co-opted a lot of the times. You know, but speaking of terms, I just wanted to ask you of, you know, how you define yourself. And you used, you know, some terms earlier, one of which I'll ask a question on sort of along this. But, you know, how do you define democratic socialism or socialism? I would say that Adam and myself, you know, describe ourselves as democratic socialists, maybe myself more socialist. I don't know, me questioning that. And would you describe yourself as one? And then also, you know, you refer to yourself as a prison abolitionist. What does that mean to you?
Okay. So growing up, I think a little anecdote is when I vividly have this story, from my mother. My mother, became a United States citizen solely to, vote down George W. Bush, and she became a Democrat. And I remember having a previous partner over for dinner, and my mother was ranting and raving about how she was the only Democrat in the household. And my partner looked at me like I had five heads and was like, what do you mean you're not a Democrat? And actually, myself, my brother, and my father were all registered independents. And that is because, as I said before, I really didn't think that the two-party system had a place for someone with my beliefs. I am an avid voter, and I do not like to be silenced or not use my voice in any sort of election. So with the way that PA voting laws are, I let go of the independent status and became a Democrat. I think that my father, when he has introduced me to his classrooms of students, he says, you know, she's running so far to the left, you can't even see her. So whatever that label means, I kind of push back against labels, because in heartfelt conversations that I have had with voters and just community members in the streets, nobody cares. They're not asking me that. They're asking me about policy, the policy that's going to change their lives and their needs. So I think that, you know, my basis is a humanitarian, and that people should have their human rights. They should have their human needs met. And that's the label that I want to run with. Am I supportive of socialist programs? 100%. And I think that they can be life-changing.
And then with the abolitionist, if you just want to, you know, mention what that means to you and such.
So before I was a candidate, I was an organizer for Mass Liberation. And Mass Liberation is basically the pushback against mass incarceration. And there's many facets to that. There's the school to prison pipeline, there's policing, and there's prisons and our criminal legal system as well. So I was specifically working on state prisons as my area, but essentially it's in this prison abolition is in this framework of restorative justice and accountability, and that imprisoning someone, putting someone into a cage is a form of punishment. And and the way that our criminal legal system works is sometimes a lot of times the wrong people get punished, or poor people get punished, or Black and Brown people get punished, and it's not really any sort of justice. But in the event that there was harm done, the punishment of prison does not fix that harm, does not resolve that harm. And as someone who has survived two sexual assaults, I do not. People have said, you know, why didn't you go to the police? Why didn't you, pursue justice through the criminal legal system? And it's because I don't believe in it. I do not believe that that is justice, that would do nothing for me. So a prison abolitionist is the push for restorative justice, because people do harm one another and there needs to be accountability for that within a community, but it's not through policing, it's not through punishment, and it's not through prison.
Agree with that 100%. And I very much like that stance. Now going into, you know, sort of some more issue-based questions, one of the policies that I know I personally most strongly advocate for myself is Medicare for All. Just over this past year, there have been so many people, I'm certain, that have, you know, lost their insurance or who've been underinsured due to the pandemic and, you know, due to losing their job, et cetera. I myself have, you know, even two stories over this past year and where I've had to call 911 for my mother, and my mother was calling 911 for my father, and got a hefty ambulance bill, and also my mom having knee surgery and the anesthesiologist being out of network, yet she was told specifically it was all in network, this is just, you know, myself from, you know, my own background, you know, being well enough off, you know, at times to actually have insurance, but also at times with my father being unemployed and my mother working at a preschool to not necessarily have health insurance. I want to ask you, why do you want Medicare for All and not a public option? Because we know that, you know, Joe Biden is in the White House and that's more what he's advocating for and what more, I'll say, traditional Democrats are advocating for in a sense.
Traditional Democrats. I'm sorry to hear about your mother and your father and your family situation. I think that the healthcare system that we currently have now is just it's a focus on profit and not on a person's health or well-being, and it makes money off of people needing help or being sick. So a single payer universal healthcare system, Medicare for All, would sever the link between healthcare protection and employment, so that unemployed Americans, new business owners, stay at home parents, and anyone else who might lack coverage altogether or who are underinsured in their insurance receive the healthcare that they deserve. With healthcare being a human right and tying it to employment makes it conditional, which is a violation of human rights. So a public option is just, it's simply put, it's insufficient. It's offering a government-sponsored health plan with publicly determined payment rates to people who could buy their own insurance. It's still capitalistic. It still fits into that for-profit model, and it doesn't respond to the need that we have of just universal healthcare.
Yeah, I mean, that pretty much says it all. Well, speaking of for-profit models, Nick and I, another big issue for us is education. I personally, I'm a substitute teacher right now. I'm certified to teach social studies like your father. And Nick, you're going to grad school for higher education. So we just wanted to ask a few questions about education. First of all, why do you think it's so important? Let me rephrase that. What would your approach be to student debt?
Cancel it all. And also to be mindful of language with how people talk about student debt. When people call it student debt forgiveness, I think that that's pretty damaging to the cause. And it's not understanding that we don't have to be in this position of having student debt looming over our heads. Having tuition-free public college is very possible simply if our government decided to grant that. And so with the way that higher education works right now is basically as young people, as children, we're sold the American dream that you climb the ladder by going after education and educating yourself. And that's how you'll get a better paying job and so on and so forth. But in doing that, we accumulate debt that actually doesn't allow for upward economic mobility, because we have to, instead of, you know, with that higher paying job, being able to invest that in whatever facet of economy you'd like to, you have to grapple with the debt. So it's not, it's continuing to hold people down if you don't come from generational wealth. So I support all student debt cancellation and I find the conversation calling it forgiveness damaging to the cause.
I agree with that too. I personally have signed up and I am a member of the Debt Collective, which I know follows you on Twitter and such. And actually one of my professors is an organizer within it and such. And they do some pretty cool things around that. And very much Adam and I appreciate that, like especially that language, because it's something that is a policy choice. And it's something that actually, you know, used to be free in, you know, various states across the country. And I'm not saying for everyone, there were plenty of, you know, Black and brown folk who were not able to go to schools due to segregation and, you know, such. But it was something that was actually technically free or just about free. So, you know, it's very much a policy choice. I'll let Adam ask the next question.
So, now more for K-12 education. What are your opinions on charter schools? Because I think I've heard you talk about, I think Nick, you showed me that you had a video with Marianne Williamson, and I think you talked about it briefly. What are your opinions on charter schools? How would you approach that issue?
So education is actually going to be a massive pillar of my campaign. We are essentially almost writing out policy on it, it's very robust and thorough. And then we plan to really roll it out to Philadelphia first and then get feedback and then try to push it across the country. And it's the New Deal for Education. And that is essentially, it's taking funding for public schools to the federal level and taking it off local taxes, which is where we've seen so much inequity fall because of local taxes. So it's putting it on the federal government that can very much afford to pay all the schools. It's increasing the base of a teacher salary. It's changing language certification requirements, things like that. And as for, there's a component that talks about charter school regulation, and it does have to be regulated because it's a divestment from our public school education and it hurts us. In this piece of the New Deal for Education, is actually modeled after the state of Texas. They have pretty robust regulations upon charter schools. And so we've been looking into their policy there and expanding it federally.
Awesome. Now, speaking of new deals, or as one candidate that we know accidentally called it, the new Green Deal, we actually had an interview. I know it's its own craziness. We actually had an interview with a candidate for another elected office who said that he would just be happy with 80% of what would be in the Green New Deal pass. Would you be happy with 80%? Yes, no, why?
No. Without knowing or understanding anything about this other person, I don't think that they fully grasp the climate crisis that we are facing and the sense of urgency that the Green New Deal is not going to fix the climate crisis. And so we have to respond with the Green New Deal and more. That's just the start. And so 80% of the Green New Deal is not sufficient, and it's not going to give us the sustainable world that we are sounding the alarms and fighting for, that people need to pay attention and get involved. And the way that capitalism and the patriarchy and white supremacy, the way that they all work, they just, you know, take, and we're running out of time and we're running out of life on this planet. And so I think that the advocacy for Green New Deal and the climate crisis has been a little bit shut down because people are like, oh, you're just fear mongering or you don't understand the science. But there really needs to be a baseline of understanding of the sense of urgency. So 100% of the Green New Deal and more.
Yeah, the candidate we talked to, he signed the Sunrise Movement's Green New Deal pledge. And when he said that, I was thinking, you know, it's not the 80% of the Green New Deal pledge, it's the Green New Deal pledge. So, and there's a reason why it's at that. Well, you know, I mean, that's what you need to do. I mean,
so one of Howie Klein is one of my endorsers, endorsements. Blue America has endorsed this campaign, and Howie Klein chooses the candidates that he wants to endorse based on not if they have progressive values, but if they're willing to fight for them. And so what he's seeing in Congress, and probably in U.S. Senate, is that yes, people will sign on to Medicare for All. And he has been saying to me, you know, even if my opponent for my race, it's a little bit easier because my opponent hasn't signed on to Medicare for All. For other progressives, their opponent has signed on to Medicare for All, but they're not fighting for it. And so the same thing with the Green New Deal and the Sunrise Agreement. Sure, they'll sign on to it, but then will they fight for it? Will they understand the urgency? Not necessarily.
It's very easy to sign a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I guess we can move on to COVID, because I mean, that's pretty relevant nowadays.
Yeah.
I know on your website, and I know we're just basing things off what you said on your website, and that's not always like always the complete story. I know you talk about how with COVID-19 response measures, like having monthly checks and things like that. But I think, you know, if you get into office, it'll be the end of 2022 by that point. And so I imagine by then the pandemic and a lot of those emergency measures may have already subsided. But a lot of the damage done by the pandemic will go on for years after it's over. So what are you going to do to repair all that damage, or try?
Well, I mean, not to keep coming back to Medicare for All, but that's a major piece of it, is to repair the damage done from the pandemic. You have to have a holistic human rights response and really acknowledge the damage. I think, and again, one of the frustrating pieces that pushed me to make this run for office was that our government was talking about the economy, and that if we fixed the economy, everything was good, because, you know, all we care about is capitalism and continuing to grind the wheels of capitalism. So we actually have to take a step back and recognize that our response to the pandemic has been devastating. It's cost us lives, and we need to build up our infrastructure so that should the next pandemic hit, which with climate change, it's likely that it will, with COVID-19 and it mutating into different variants, we could be dealing with this for a very long time. So we have to continue to put out monthly checks and to find a system that isn't reliant on last year's tax forms, tax filings. We have to pass Medicare for all. We need to ensure that if we're going to tell people to stay home, that they can stay home. They have the means to stay home. And so that brings the conversation to, you know, what utilities should be universal. And one of the things that really hurt our schools and our students is that they didn't have broadband at home. So we had kids who were in parking lots trying to keep up with school and sitting outside the school in parking lots during the scariest pieces of the pandemic, our children. So how do we respond? We need to, yes, repair the damage done as much as we can, but then also work in a preventative fashion for the next pandemic as well.
Definitely agree with you there. And I'll even mention that when I was thinking of more originally going into like K-12 education and such. When I was student teaching, I was actually in the Oxford area school district. And I want to say that there were two teachers that I know of that did not have internet at home. And those are teachers. Mm-hmm. So, I think it's especially important to hit, you know, those like notes I'll say of, you know, we need actual broadband for everyone. We need to make sure that this is, you know, here for people, because if you do need it, you have it. And most people probably do need it to, you know, to work, to live. And, yeah. You know, especially when we're doing so many more things online and, you know, paperless and things, even from like, you know, the government in different ways. Now, something that I heard you mention earlier of your work, I believe you said with the Lakota tribe, I was just, you know, interested to hear more about the work that you have done with them and the work that you'll continue to do for, as your website, you say, justice for tribal nations and, you know, and how you're going to support Native communities.
That has a very special place in my heart. I think that, and I speak specifically to the Lakota, but in my understanding, peripheral understanding of other Indigenous communities, that their culture is incredibly beautiful. And so the work that I've done, originally, it was manual labor. I was digging holes, helping them to insulate their trailers, building steps or wheelchair ramps, because I mean, just the conditions on a reservation are horrendous. Every disparity that you can think of, they're suffering. And there is a lot of anger with our government that in treaties that were made years ago, our government promised to care for them, and that has not been done. Other things that I've done with the tribe has been, one of their major concerns is about suicide and suicide prevention. And they believe that, and I share this belief, that their children are dying because they're not being instilled with their culture, and they are seeing the racism and the hatred prevalent in current United States society, and just believing that there's not a place in this world for them. And then they're taking their own life. So the suicide prevention model was to encourage Lakota culture and the maintenance of it and the passing on to younger generations, their language, their traditions, their beliefs, their practices. This is some things I have been fortunate to participate in sweat lodges, and they're just, I believe that if our whole world could participate in a sweat lodge, we would be a better place. So in my time on the reservation within this community, I've always had the question of, you know, how can I help in a way that you want to be helped? And that is the framework. It's kind of a partnership instead of, you know, this is what you need and I'm going to do it regardless of if you agree with it or if you don't. And that needs to be changed with our government and in their dealings with the tribe. They're also in their response to that is simply, you know, bringing them up, making sure that they're not erased. Because I was reading something on social media that said, you know, where were the major regions that Native Americans used to live? And an Indigenous child responded, "We still live here. Like, they're still here. They have their culture and their beliefs, and they're still living on reservations, or they're integrated into our communities." And just the negligence and the erasure needs to be pushed back and advocated against. So that it's my plan is just to continue to lift awareness about the tribal nations and that they are not forgotten, and bring that to modern day society, and then to fight back against the paternalistic relationship between United States government and tribal government.
Now, well said. And I also want to point out, and this is just because I'm a graduate assistant at Westchester University's Center for Civic Engagement. And, you know, we do a lot of service, and I very much appreciate the, you know, you need to ask these communities what they need before actually doing anything and not have like the white savior complex sort of thing. Because I've seen that far too many times of, you know, people who will just like trample in, and like it could be anything. It could just be you donating at a food bank and like giving something that they don't necessarily need. And like, while that's great, sure. But a lot of the times that can actually be doing more harm than good, because they'll have to squander resources, et cetera. And that's just on that level. And then when you're talking about Native communities, you really need to ask, because I'm certain people do not actually have the understanding. And as you even pointed out, you know, you've just worked with the Lakota, and you need to be mindful and actually asking each separate community of what their real needs are.
Completely. Yes. And that's a very important point to make. I've had friends of mine who said, you know, you've worked with Native communities in the past. What do they like to be called? And I say Lakota, because I've worked with the Lakota, and I've had them say to me, you know, some of them find Native American offensive, some of them find American Indian offensive. And I've had recent conversations where they're like, what are you calling us now? And I'm like, Indigenous. And they're like, okay, right. So they refer to themselves as Lakota, and it's by tribe. And that's how they identify. And that to be respectful of these individual communities, you need to call them by what they want to be called.
All right. To kind of pivot to another very erased group of people, you know, immigration is a big topic in the news right now, you know, for various reasons. It's been called a crisis at the border. There are different viewpoints on that. But I just want to ask, what are your opinions on the Biden administration's approach to immigration thus far?
I am not supportive of them. I don't think that they are informed of the big picture. I think, how can I put this? I think we need to recognize why there's such large immigration, and also why the United States should be accepting these refugees. We are seeing a lot of immigration from Central America. And we also play a very big role in destabilizing governments in Central America. And we do that very quietly. And so as a consequence of destabilizing governments, there people leave because there's violence, there's economic instability. And then we can also talk about how they're paying a higher price for the climate crisis. So they're moving, they're literally migrating to safer area at that where, you know, the United States, even with all our protests and our own response to the pandemic, we are in a more stable place than a lot of Central American governments and countries. So I think that the Biden administration is kind of like, you know, hands up in the air being like, why is this happening? And not tracing back to, well, we caused it. Like the United States caused it. And in an accountability framework, we would be taking these asylum seekers. So I do not agree with how I think it's very more of the same that we've seen with white supremacy, the patriarchy, and capitalism of the Biden administration just kind of being like, we don't know how this happened, and not taking responsibility for it.
Yeah, and what's insane to me is that it seems when it's framed as a crisis, it's not the crisis isn't that all these people are suffering, it's that we can't send them back fast enough.
Right.
That seems to be, I remember a few weeks ago, Biden tweeted something out about how if you're coming from Haiti, stay there, you know. And it's like this is supposed to be leadership, you know.
Yeah. Did he really? I'm not even sure if I follow President Biden on Twitter.
I don't think I do.
I don't think there's a need to. I think the only thing we noticed from him was his dog, like a long time ago when everyone in Texas was freezing. And then, you know, like the dog, like Pawfist account or whatever, was like cozied up by the fire, like, don't worry. And it's like, why? Why? Just stop.
Yeah, the real news story. Major Biden.
Yeah.
Gosh, I can't. Well, still staying on with Biden, you know, one of the big things as well with his administration has been this $2 trillion infrastructure plan. Now, granted, that's over 10 years and such, you know, and the White House made a statement of saying, you know, like great projects of the past, the president's plan will unify and mobilize the country to meet the great challenges of our time, the climate crisis and the ambitions of an autocratic China. First, do you agree with this framing of an infrastructure bill? And then second, do you feel that this plan adequately addresses the climate crisis?
No, I do not agree with the framing of this. I think that infrastructure is an issue in every single major city. And I know that it's such an issue in Philadelphia. And that we need more people talking about infrastructure. So I'm glad that an infrastructure of a large infrastructure bill is being released and passed, but it's not enough. Like we need so much more It seems that we have been seeing this pattern repeat of a response to a crisis, and it scratches the surface and it says, why aren't you happy? And then we on the left who believe we deserve so much more and need so much more are accused of whining and being unpleasable. But this is there's so much more need, and that this infrastructure bill does not cover it. And I think that another thing I forgot to mention with the response to COVID is the federal jobs guarantee. which I think kind of plays a role into this as well. We've seen massive unemployment. We've seen massive unemployment of young people from the age of 16 to 22. I know Philadelphia's statistics. I think we're seeing as high as 17%, and that's a crisis. And so we need people, we need to treat unemployment like it is the crisis that it is, because people are not going to be able to recover from this. So infrastructure is, to me, jobs, but we need to go with employing everybody and eliminating unemployment. And it's possible. It's a policy choice again.
No, very much agree. Okay. Well, another, you know, topic that I'm certain hits close to home, as you have mentioned. And, you know, to frame this in some of a sense as, you know, looking back from the 2020 presidential election or like the primaries and such, you know, we know that sort of like more like progressive presidential candidates, you know, in 2020, like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren were quote unquote, like open to decriminalizing sex work, but of course not, you know, really going the full force in a sense. So firstly, why do you believe it should be decriminalized, and how can we get this position to be more widely accepted, and why should it be a more pressing issue?
So I think what people from outside these communities don't realize is that it is, first we have to come into the concept of criminalization and what gets criminalized. And so sex work is deeply criminalized, drug use is deeply criminalized, and poverty is deeply criminalized. So we have people who are trying to find ways to get by, trying to find ways to make ends meet, whether it's through sex work or numbing themselves through drugs, or they just like to use drugs, or they're simply impoverished because that's what life has thrown at them. And then these groups are criminalized. So the necessity to decriminalize both sex work and drug use is major, because that is what is contributing to our exploding population who is currently incarcerated. And then the consequences that people face of being criminalized plays out for the rest of their life. If I know people who have come out of the carceral system, she works for trans justice at ACLU. She was incarcerated, and she was formerly a prostitute. And now, even though she has a stable, happy, loving home to offer a child, she cannot adopt. And that is just there. There's so much need for love in this world that continuing on the platform of seeking to criminalize, seeking to punish people, it's heading us down that path to self-destruction. So I'm trying to get back to the question. Why is it so important?
And why should it, you know, and how can we get it more widely accepted within, I'll say, you know, like mainstream-esque okay. circles, if you want to say.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to, I mean, first of all, we don't talk about sex, and we don't provide sex education, and it's so taboo. And then because of that, we see young people who are not informed on consent, who aren't informed on safe sex, and can contract, a sexually transmitted disease or become pregnant. And then, you know, from there, the contraction of an STD is actually criminalized. And abortions are not very favorable in society either. So it's just, you're just, you know, punishing people and punishing people for punishing people. And it's just a downward cycle. So how do we make this more normal? We talk about sex in a healthy manner and normalize it and accept that, you know, to a degree, we are biological creatures who have sex. We accept sex workers who, you know, for whatever reason, and one of the things that gets very conflated is sex work is not sex trafficking. Sex work is someone's choosing to participate in sex work for whatever reason they have, whether it's sexual liberation, whether it's to pay the bills, whether it's to, you know, cope with some trauma that they're going through. There's a lot of different reasons that someone might choose to participate in sex work. Sex trafficking is a different issue and it's not the same. And combating sex trafficking shouldn't touch the sex work community. So normalizing sex workers, allowing sex workers to have that second job of being a teacher, being a soccer coach, being a nurse, being a lawyer. I know sex workers who have that second job as they try to pay their school debt, and they come from all different walks of life. So making it less taboo, bringing it out of the shadows, that's going to protect sex workers. It's going to decriminalize it. And then also pushing back against laws that are passed that criminalize prostitution and criminalize loitering. Those would do a lot.
No, I think that's very important. And I'll even mention that I know in my grad program, I know a person or two who has recommended the book Sexual Citizen and such, you know, because it is something that it's not widely educated upon or, you know, very much miseducated upon in terms of sex, you know, for a variety of reasons, right? But, you know, as you pointed out, it's very much pressing. It's very much something that should actually be talked about. And people, I don't know, people just have this fear that I feel like that, you know, talking about sex is wrong because it's, you know, instilled in so many of us. And I'll say for myself, you know, being raised somewhat a little bit more like Catholic, you know, conservative-esque, you know, definitely never really talked about it, never really, you know, told anything about it, you know, but it's important to. And, you know, I thank you for, you know, at least sharing some of like that experience as well, because I think that that's something that, you know, it's not like that should have to happen in order to get this, you know, decriminalized, but it's something that is important in the process of, you know, going about doing so in a way. Sort of last sort of like serious issue question is you've described on your website, and then you even have mentioned during this interview of, you know, sexual assault. And, you know, we wanted to ask you of how you plan to advocate for sexual assault victims and end violence against women as a member of Congress.
Well, I think that, so I apologize for continuing to talk about the patriarchy. And I think that what people misunderstand,
by all means.
What people misunderstand is that the issue with the patriarchy is not, it is yes, that women deserve to be in places where decisions are being made, especially about them, but it's actually more of a construct. And from the patriarchal construct, there is that dialogue of we know best, you don't know what you're talking about, you don't understand your body, you don't, you know, all of that. And it also comes at it from a place of punishment. And in a matriarchal construct, there's that restorative justice framework. And from my time working within an organization that responded to sexual and domestic violence, that restorative justice and accountability framework was much more healing than punishment, because it so I think educating people that in my own survivorship that I seek restorative justice and I seek accountability and also laying that framework for sexual assault victims to pursue that sort of justice is also important. I'm trying to remember the next piece of your question. So how would I advocate for sexual assault victims
and violence against women?
And violence against women. So there's also the funding of the Violence Against Women Act. And another piece is
Title IX, I think.
Yes, thank you. Title IX, what people don't realize is what Trump's administration did to Title IX. And they basically put a time constraint and put limitations on how a sexual assault victim could come forward and demand justice. I found this out a couple of months ago, and it's so sickening and infuriating. How that administration re-victimized victims. So undoing that, funding the Violence Against Women Act, and then also raising the issue of this violence is very much perpetuated in erased and marginalized communities. And so bringing forward the violence that Indigenous women face, and that sex workers face, and that drug users face, women who use drugs face. These like extremely marginalized communities face violence with no consequence. And so the accountability framework has to move throughout all levels of our country and our government. To basically end misogyny.
All right. Okay, just a few more very, very quick questions. We know you got to go soon. Okay, here's a fun one. If you could bring back one person from the dead in American history, who would it be and why? Bring them to the present.
There's a sister duo that I greatly admire, Sarah and Angelina Grimke. Oh. They are Southern women abolitionists, and they fought for slavery abolition, and they also fought for women's rights, and they fought for it through the framework of, no sister is free until every single sister is free. And so I really greatly admire that. And if I could bring them back and have a conversation with them, about what was hard, what their strategy was, I would bring those two back.
Awesome.
Love that. Love that. It makes me think of one of my faves, Eugene Debs, and saying, I am, if there's a criminal element, I am of it. So I know I asked you this actually at a Meet the Challenger event, but what is your biggest issue with the Democratic Party?
I try not to give different answers from what I've already given, but I don't remember what my answer was. I would say that my biggest issue is that they like to claim that they are of the working class and yet do not move in favor of the working class, and just continue to line their pockets with corporate greed and corporate special interests. And that to me is just hypocrisy, right in front of our faces. And it really drives me nuts.
Very much agreed here. Go ahead.
Okay, it's a final question. How can somebody volunteer support and vote for you?
Please vote for me. Voting registration is very easy, and that's something that we're going to be working on over the summer, if they're not already registered. I think mail-in ballots is definitely the way to go, especially knowing how Philadelphia elections tend to go, that if I can get mail-in ballots and have the majority of people doing that, then we could kind of maybe dodge some corruption that could happen. Mm-hmm. How can they volunteer? They can volunteer through our website. There's a sign-up form. It talks about, you know, what's your skill set, why, and then we have our volunteer lead who reaches out and kind of vets the person, and then brings them on. And how else can they support? You can donate. You can follow us on social media. We have Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. And that really spreading campaign material, campaign messaging, especially as we roll out issue-based campaigns, is going to be very important as we navigate running a grassroots campaign and, you know, can't really afford advertisement and just how to reach people.
No, very much agreed. And I will say, to sort of end it, I have started to volunteer for Alexander's campaign, not too much yet, but I will probably try to do a little bit more in the summer. So disclosing that for folks who are like, ooh, you know, what questions did you ask and why? And that sort of sense. But no, thank you, Alexander, for being here. If you, you know, have any final, you know, words or things that you want to say before you go, feel free. The floor is yours. And, you know, just again, thank you for being with us. You know, it's been great to ask you questions, get to know you a little bit more, you know, and best of luck.
Thank you for having me. And I think that I would close with this. We're not in a good state right now. We're not in a good place. But that there are a lot of people with big hearts in this world who are fighting for better and to stay hopeful and to stay involved. So I'll end with that.
Well said. Well said.
All right. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, this has been Non-Applicable. My name is Nick.
I am Adam.
And then our guest.
I'm Alexandra Hunt.
All right. Well, thank you for listening.